Okay. Well, I will deal with Gaza. I don't think there's any question about it, but I'm going to begin with small boats because we've seen the ping-ponging between the House of Lords and the House of Commons. This is for the Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill. And this is an example of Parliament having the right to call what is black white and what's white is black, i.e., Rwanda is a safe place. Well, it most certainly isn't. But of course, this was one of Sunak's famous, I would actually say stupid, but hey, stupid. Five pledges. When I heard them, I thought to myself, well, okay, I get it when you talk about bringing inflation down. I don't know anybody who seriously thought inflation would continue to go up. As far as I was aware, everyone thought it would go down. And lo and behold, not because of the government, but globally, inflation has gone down. On the other hand, when I heard him saying he would stop, quote unquote, stop the small boats, remember his podiums with the slogan in front of it, not reduce, stop. I have to say that I laughed out loud. And this is, of course, this Safety of Rwanda Asylum Immigration Bill, as it is at the moment, is part and parcel of fulfilling that pledge. And the idea is that you frighten people to such a damned extent, they won't get in those inflatables and will decide to either come by non-irregular means, i.e., legal means, or they'll decide to stay in France, or hey, I'm so afraid of being sent to Rwanda, I'm going back home. It's a very unlikely scenario. You know, Britain isn't Australia. And what we're dealing with when it comes to Britain is, you know, closer, if we want an analogy, to Texas. And so if you take Latin America, those countries hit by civil war, social breakdown, economic crisis, people will naturally head north, head to the United States. And no matter what walls have been built, they will find a way in. And so in Britain, there was a clampdown, remember, on the lorries. They introduced sniffer dogs, all sorts of draconian fines. There was a clampdown on the Channel Tunnel. And lo and behold, then people start coming in small boats. Well, my prediction, for what it's worth, it's not worth anything. You won't get very long odds, is that people will keep coming for the same reasons. All you need to do is look at where people come from. And I'm not talking about from Calais, I'm talking about where people originate from. And it tends to list off all the countries that have undergone some sort of meltdown, either because of the IMF, foreign intervention, economic collapse, you name it. But let's list them off. Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran. That's a good starter. And if we looked at Italy and the Mediterranean, it's not just going to be Libya. It's going to be places, you know, such as Chad, Mali, and other such countries. So they will keep coming. There's no doubt about that. Okay, the Institute for Public Policy Research has produced a paper. I would guess that most comrades would have seen reference to it in the press and in the media. And what they estimate is for the 300 people that are going to be sent over to that safe place called Rwanda, it will cost per person £230,000, which is a total of 1.8 million. And that rises, of course, because we're not just talking about a one-off, we're talking about keeping people there. And over a 5-year period, the estimated cost is 3.9 billion. And the Institute for Public Policy Research estimate that in order to break even compared with housing asylum seekers in ex-RAF, barracks or in hotels or wherever, to break even, this Rwanda policy would have to put off two-thirds of the irregular migrants. Now, last year, 2023, there were 36,704 of them. So you'd have to put an awful lot of these people off in order for the government to actually say that this has worked in terms of finance. Remember, finance. But I don't think it's going to put two-thirds off. I don't think it's going to put a third off. I don't think it's going to put anyone seriously off because it's such a tiny percentage when it comes to irregular migration that most people will regard it as the equivalent of a drowning in the channel. It's a risk, it's a real possibility, but on balance, it's a remote possibility, and much better to take the risk of coming over in a small boat. Okay, you might be denied the legal right of applying for asylum. That's true. But what you do is you simply disappear into the black economy. And a couple of weeks ago, the I newspaper published an investigation that they'd conducted into delivery drivers. Now, that's just one aspect of, how should you put it, the grey and black economy. And what it showed is that registered delivery drivers, here's my forms, here's my birth certificate, or whatever else you have to produce, can sell or hire out their right to deliver. They're part of the loop. Pick it up here, deliver it there, we'll give you your slice, either at the end of the day or the end of the week. I don't know how it works. But loads of these guys, of course, are going to be illegal workers. And if it isn't delivery drivers, then people will find work on building sites or in nail bars or whatever, prostitution, criminal actions, whatever it is. The fact of the matter is that the chances are they'll be a lot better off in Britain than they would if they'd stayed back at home wherever they came from. But as I stressed, of course, this isn't about money. This is actually about politics. This is about Rishi Sunak's pledges. And look at me, we're on the right direction. That's what he's hoping for, I think, in autumn. Of course, when the English Channel starts to get rough, where the weather starts to deteriorate, he'll be able to point and saying it's not the weather, not that he'll say that, but he'll claim, of course, it's Rwanda that's putting people off. Meanwhile, of course, what we have is especially those at the bottom end of the labour market, understandably, complaining about unfair competition. After all, if you're an illegal worker and you can be reported as such, and the immigration police come and take you away, the chances are that you're going to try to undercut workers who are legally based in Britain. And of course, it should be stressed, paradoxically, that since Brexit, where Boris Johnson, don't you remember, and Nigel Farage were saying it's about controlling our borders, the number of legal migrants has actually increased. So the actual issue itself isn't going to go away, even if they got rid of irregular migration in total, which they're not going to do. So how should the workers' movement respond to this? Well, we can respond, I suppose, by saying no to migration, no to unfair competition. That's delusional. As I've said, you know, you make everyone illegal, and then you're going to have even more competition, actually, when it comes to the labour market, with employers ignoring the law, ignoring the threats, because they can hire the lawyers, or they can produce, you know, new companies off the peg at a moment's notice. Either way, that isn't the answer, nor is the answer, in my view. I understand the sentiments. I appreciate the sentiments. You know, asylum seekers. Notice the word asylum seekers. That means good migrants. Asylum seekers are welcome here. Well, they might be welcome by you or me, but they're not welcome, certainly when it comes to competition in the labour market. And certainly when it comes not to asylum seekers, but those are actually barred now from claiming asylum, that competition in terms of lower wages, worse conditions and all the rest of it will increase, not decrease. So our perspective is very much along the lines of, well, people have the right to live where they want to live. But what we demand, right, is organization. What we demand, and what the labor movement should be demanding, is trade union conditions across the board. Trade union conditions, trade union pay. And we would add to that the perspective of organizing workers into a workers' party, no matter what country they came from, and at the present time, no matter what their legal status. So that's really small boats covered, at least for this week, except to say, of course, that we would expect eventually the government to get its way, and the bill will become an act. And as I said, I think it will become an act in the run-up to the general election, and I think we should expect it to feature heavily in the general election. Okay, over to Gaza, over to New York, over to the UN, over to the UN Security Council, and the 11 votes for the US resolution calling for a ceasefire. There were votes against it, three votes in total. One was Algeria. Remember, the Security Council includes permanent members, but also rotating members. And the two that mattered, the two that could veto, did veto, and that was China and Russia. And what the United States has said is this is playing politics. Well, the United States has so far had a record in the United Nations of vetoing calls for a ceasefire, because, according to them, what they want is a permanent ceasefire. Well, this time they've just gone for a ceasefire. Well, that shows that they're under pressure, and that's to be welcome. But if you look at the actual resolution, what it also included is not the call, but one of the conditions was that Hamas handed over all the so-called hostages. And the reason why I say so-called is because some of them surely must be classified as prisoners of war. If you look at October the 7th, surely that was an act of war. If you look at Gaza under siege, if you look at the history of Israel since it was formed, certainly 67, that war, there's been a war against the Palestinians since the foundation of Israel. And of course, there's also been a situation where internationally recognized Palestinian areas, i.e. the West Bank and Gaza, have in effect been under Israeli occupation or control. And that describes Gaza. And therefore, if we look at the act of Hamas, clearly it needs to be seen in the context of not something that came out of the blue, but an act of resistance to occupation and to dispossession by the state of Israel. So, in that sense, I'm not agreeing with Russia on anything else. Russia's right to say that Israel would have used this resolution if it had been passed, I would guess, to say that it was justified in continuing its military action because Hamas hasn't agreed to hand over all the so-called hostages. Remember this, that since October the 7th, something like, I mean, I don't know the exact figure, but something like 7,000 Palestinians have been arrested on the West Bank, not in Gaza, not as captives there, but on the West Bank. So Israel is accumulating more and more prisoners as we speak, leaving aside the 32,000 or thereabouts deaths in Gaza itself. Nonetheless, this move by the United States isn't without significance. And I myself, I would say this shows the United States bending, buckling under pressure. It's buckling in part, I think we would have to say, because of the pending presidential election in the United States and the potential role that the Arab Palestinian vote can play in certain states in the US. I mean, Michigan comes to mind, but also I think we need to be looking at the regional picture. I don't take this shift by the United States as being a response to potential deaths on an unimaginable scale in Gaza, which surely is going to come. I mean, the UN's talking about 1 million people on the edge of starvation. What happens with starvation is people usually don't die of starvation. They usually die before that of disease. They catch something, their body cannot resist the bugs, and they go down with this, that, or the other transmittable disease in very large numbers. But I think what the United States fears is what's going to happen if that starts to happen in the region. What's going to happen in Egypt? What's going to happen in Saudi Arabia? What's going to happen in Jordan? And it isn't, as it's been pointed out to me, it's not simply a question, as I've been hammering on about, although I think this is a factor. What happens on the Arab street, but also what happens in the middle ranks of the armed forces of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt. What do these people do as their fellow Arabs, die of hunger and disease? Or does Israel either allow or create a situation of where it busts a hole in the wall that divides Sinai from Gaza? If that happens, I don't think it's just a question that Egypt tears up its peace deal with Israel. I think that the regime itself, as with other such regimes, are actually in danger. And I think that's what the United States is concerned about. And that's what it's fearful of. Plus, as I said, the possible role of Arab and Palestinian voters in the November elections. Well, okay, so the US ceasefire call fell, but we've had the UN General Secretary renewing his call for a ceasefire without the question of hostages, POWs, being included in that, simply saying, look at the situation in Gaza. This is intolerable. Relief must come in. Aid workers must come in, and that means the tanks, the aircraft, the drones have to be stood down. That's his simple message. And of course, predictably, literally as day follows night and night follows day, we've had Israel Katz, he's the Israeli defense minister, denouncing the UN General Secretary and the UN as a whole as, yeah, you guessed it, as anti-Semitic, that the UN shelters and emboldens terror. Well, my argument would be on the contrary. It's the United States and Israel that not only emboldens and shelters terror, but is actually either indirectly responsible for that terror, 30,000 plus deaths, 32,000, whatever the exact number, or is directly responsible for those deaths and countless more over the forthcoming weeks, with Netanyahu saying that whatever the United States says, whatever the United States does, we will carry on into Rafah. So where, what is it, 1.5 million people, where are they expected to go, Netanyahu? I haven't heard any suggestion. And that's why I at least wouldn't be surprised. I'm not predicting it, but I wouldn't be surprised if Israel engineers a situation or directly breaches Egypt's wall and simply says, well, if Sisi wants to order his troops to fire on these people, go ahead. Because I don't see him giving that order for mass killing. One, two, three, a dozen, 2 dozen, yeah, but surely no more. Okay. I would also add, I mean, maybe I'm late on this, but I watched the Al Jazeera documentary on October the 7th. And okay, it's sort of confirmed my expectations that this is the sort of thing I think happened. And that's a dangerous thing because it's always, isn't it, flattering to find someone agreeing with you? I always find it. So anyway, so looking at this documentary, I have to say that everything that I thought sort of was confirmed, presuming that the documentary was accurate and wasn't a pack of lies. And I don't think it's a pack of lies. I think it's something that stands up to serious journalistic investigation. Anyway, lo and behold, no surprise, the story is about the depths of depravity that Hamas was instantly accused of. Turn out to be either mistaken, if we're on the generous side, or invented, but certainly ran with. So stories about pregnant women being opened up and the fetus being stabbed, that turns out to be untrue. That if you look at the kibbutz where this is meant to have happened, there was no woman in that stage of pregnancy that was killed. So we had the guy that apparently originated the story, confronted with this information and said, no, it's accurate. Look at my phone. The journalist looked at his phone and said, well, I can't see it. So maybe this guy, one of the Israel's first responders, went in there and saw what he thought he'd see, or saw what he wanted to see, that Hamas were sort of somehow subhuman, and therefore this tangled mess of bones and guts and gore. He saw some sort of story and he repeated it, repeated it, repeated it. The problem is that it's not just him that ran with this story. Joe Biden, not only with the fetus, but with young children executed by Hamas. Well, it turns out that in a kibbutz with 12 children, who were blown up by Hamas and executed and all the rest. Turns out there were only two children, and the two children turn out to have been killed by Israeli tanks, not Hamas fighters. And you carry on. What about the rape stories? Myself, as I've argued, I think it's surely credible. It would surely be incredible to imagine thousands of Hamas fighters plus thousands of Gazans following them into Israeli territory. Surely it's incredible to imagine that no rapes happened. One thing that graphically came over in the Al Jazeera thing, shot, by the way, in the main from the body cameras of Hamas fighters, either captured by Israel or loaded up since in Gaza, I don't know. Either way, what it graphically showed to me is what you'd expect: the profound, deep, deep hatred of Israelis in terms of Hamas fighters. I'm sure that some Israelis were treated nice, but not in this documentary. Doesn't surprise me. But rapes, we were told that there were systematic rapes. Well, the evidence isn't there. So on the Israeli side, they haven't produced any evidence. They produce verbal evidence of people seeing something, right? But they haven't produced any evidence that would stand up in court. They haven't produced anyone saying, I was raped. They haven't produced a situation of where on the body cameras of Hamas fighters, there's any evidence of someone being raped. So they have your NGO woman who said, yeah, when you get war, when you get men with guns, when you get civilians, there will be rapes. Yeah, you had that. But she said, and this is the significant thing, we don't have any evidence for it. So you would expect it. But it wasn't just Joe Biden. It wasn't just Blinken. It wasn't just Netanyahu. This was the Times. This was the Daily Mirror. This was every mainstream media outlet ran with this story. And you still get a situation of where Israeli politicians, leading Israeli politicians and diplomats and generals still come out with they killed babies, they murdered, they raped. And what this Al Jazeera film confirms is the story about Israel acting in such a way that not only soldiers who'd been captured by Hamas, but civilians who'd been captured either by Hamas or by irregulars coming out of Gaza, that Israeli helicopter gunships were firing on cars that they suspected were carrying hostages to kill them. And when people fled cars, you had the guys in the helicopter with the heavy machine guns killing everybody. And again, some expert witnesses, well, there's no way that these guys could tell, who was Israeli, who was a Hamas fighter, who was a Gazan irregular. They were just killing, killing, killing. And that was true also in kibbutz. And they were just showing you, well, look, here's the Hamas fighters. They're armed with Kalashnikovs. They're armed with, shoulder launched missiles. But they certainly don't have tanks that you'd need to put the sort of hole in the wall that we have in front of us here in terms of film or video evidence. So Israel was certainly responsible for a large number of casualties on both sides, but including its own side. Okay, so we still have a situation of where, one lie, and before the truth can catch up, it's seven leagues ahead. So this story keeps running and running. But I would recommend this Al Jazeera documentary. Again, going back way, way back to when this whole thing began, I was in the situation. I was going, surely Israel knew. Surely Israel knew in advance. You know, here you've got Shin Bet, here you've got listening devices, here you've got agents. And of course, the documentary again confirmed that Israel, right up to the top, knew about Hamas. Here's the training videos and all the rest of it. Here's them, you know, smashing through practice fences and all the rest of it. But Israel was of the considered opinion, the high ups were of the considered opinion that they ain't going to be able to go through with it, that they simply lack the resources or the political will to do it. And what the documentary brought over, I thought very well, is that Hamas basically didn't think it had a choice. It was cornered. And it was looking at the diplomatic moves being made by Israel, the United States, Saudi Arabia, and other Arab Muslim countries to come to some rapprochement with Israel that would ignore the Palestinians. And Hamas basically said, what choice do we have? And therefore they gave the go-ahead. And what surprised them, the limited number that were in on the plan at the beginning, and this again, there's, you know, indirect evidence of it, they never expected the success that they had. So the targets to begin with were military targets. So it was an attack on a police station, an army base, an observation tower. These were in the instructions that were given out to their fighters. And then the fighters are in a position of, well, what do we do next? Let's go this way, let's go that way. They expected a 90% casualty rate straight away. They expected very few of them to survive. And I have to say, when they carried on to kibbutzes, when they carried on into this music festival, it was a question of indiscriminate killing. You can excuse that if you want, on the basis that all Israelis, isn't it over 18, are conscripted into the army, unless you are, I think, still of the ultra Orthodox. One of the ultra-Orthodox sects. Either way, these were unarmed and they were civilians, and there was indiscriminate killing. So I'm not trying to prettify Hamas. Hamas has got a reactionary ideology. Nonetheless, what we're dealing with here isn't the equivalent of, you know, one side simply versus the other. We're dealing with desperate people in desperate circumstances who do a desperate thing. And again, the documentary I thought got over very well, that if you dehumanize Hamas and you say this is what they've done, it excuses killing on a scale not just of one for every, not just killing 100. For everyone, but going way, way beyond that, and talk of killing not only all of Hamas, but wiping out the Palestinian population itself, which certainly in Gaza I would take seriously. And certainly when it comes to the West Bank, I would take seriously the prospect of another round of ethnic cleansing when Israel is ready. For it. Okay. Just very quickly, I've got the time, 35. Quick comment on Crocus City Hall outside Moscow. The number of dead so far, I read 137. Who did it? My understanding is that it's ISIS-K. ISIS-K is a branch of perhaps the most active branch of ISIS at the present. Why did they do it? Why did they go all the way to Moscow? Or why did they give instructions or the go-ahead for this operation in Moscow? Well, for that, you have to go to Syria and Russia's involvement in Syrian politics, and therefore the politics of ISIS. and basically an upsurge in the political activity of ISIS in Syria and in that region. That's my understanding of it. Is it Ukraine? I doubt it. Is it the United States? I doubt it. But note this, remember a couple of weeks ago, was it? Or is it less than that? The CIA was issuing warnings to American citizens of some pending terrorist attack and urging its citizens not to attend things like concerts. So the United States had some idea that something like this could happen. Why, the FSB weren't on top of it, I don't know. I mean, this is something I simply am in no position to judge. Who exactly did it, how they got the ammunition or whatever else they needed in, I don't know. But that seems to be the correct story as far as I understand it. Very quickly, over to the Ukraine war itself. My own estimate, as I've argued here, is I don't think that the Ukraine armed forces are just about to collapse. I don't think Russia's on the verge of, stunning advances. It's not the season for stunning advances. This is the rainy season. It's harder to fight in spring and autumn than it is in winter. Wait till late spring, summer, and then we should certainly expect a Russian offensive. How far it gets, I don't know. But as well as Russia digging in, note that Zelensky has also given similar orders. And at the moment, of course, what we have is a war on energy. We have Russian missiles, Russian drones raining down on power plants, and in reply, we have Ukrainian attacks on refineries and all the rest of it, with the Americans warning them that this could upset the global energy market. But as I said, my own particular take on it is I don't see any immediate change of a significant sort in terms of this war, which, of course, Putin is now using, of course, the W word. It always was a war. War is a duel on an extended scale. War is violence by, no, war is politics by other violent means. This was a war when it began, clearly. Okay, he's using the W word now. Maybe this is about mobilizing extra conscripts. I don't know. Okay, meanwhile, in Ireland, we have Leo Varadkar resigning. Apparently, he was always going to resign before he got to 50. As I understand it, he's 45. I could be wrong, something like that. I don't think this has got anything to do with him saying, well, I've always had this master plan when it comes to my politics. Look, he lost his last referendum. This was updating Ireland's constitution. He's also in a situation of where, as an individual, and not because he's homosexual as anything like that, as far as I know, he's unpopular with the population in Ireland. And of course, Ireland is due, has to have an election, a general election, before March 2025. So I think they're trying to put in Simon Harris before that. And this is then, fingers crossed, that either one or another, or both the mainstream parties in Ireland get enough votes, PR system, to form another coalition government. Or maybe one of those parties, Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil, can get enough allies around it to form its own coalition government. But of course, the leading party when it comes to opinion polls and has been the leading party for some time is, of course, Sinn Féin. And okay, over recent months, it's certainly true that Sinn Féin's lead in the opinion polls has slipped somewhat. So it's gone, for example, from 30% in the polls to 28% in terms of the latest polls. On the other hand, if we take Fine Gael, it's on 20%, and Fianna Fáil on 18%. Now, if we look at Sinn Féin and just looked at things today and said, well, let's imagine that these polls were reproduced in a general election. Okay, given PR, you put together 28% and you add 20% from Fine Gael, or you add 18% from Fianna Fáil, that isn't still enough to form a majority coalition. Hence, at least the possibility of a bigger coalition. And it's in that context I bring in Richard Boyd Barrett, of People Before Profit, Socialist Worker Network, unless I'm mistaken, but certainly part of the international socialist tendency led by Britain's Socialist Workers' Party and Alex Kalinikos. And of course, Richard Boyd Barrett has been raising this prospect of joining what he's called a left government. Now, you have to say that a government that includes either Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil, you'd be hard pushed to call it left. Indeed, I would argue that you'd be hard pushed to call Sinn Féin left nowadays, not least in its response to its dip in opinion polls, which is often being put down to migration. Ireland's gone from being an exporter of people almost year by year by year by year for 100, 200 years to now an importer of people. And that's created some sort of political reaction. And Sinn Féin is basically jettisoning at least some of its fluffy rhetoric for we're going to be hard, tough on migrants rhetoric. Either way, the point would be that that is not something that you should rule out, a grand coalition in which People Before Profit get their position as a junior minister or maybe even a minister. With his own car, let alone the ministerial salary and other such perks. And of course, that is something I still have to get my head around that you would have thought the IST tradition, the International Socialist Tendency tradition, the SWP tradition, the IS tradition, whatever you want to call it, the Cliffites. You would have thought this would be something that they would instinctively reject because, behind them, next to them, whichever direction you want to face, they will have their copies of Leon Trotsky's writings in the 1930s. And of course, Leon Trotsky famously equated the Popular Front term by the Communist International. Under the leadership of Georgi Dimitrov, in reality, Joseph Stalin, the turn to coalitionism, the turn to backing the progressive bourgeoisie against the reactionary bourgeoisie in 1935, he equated that with having the same significance as the betrayal by the majority of parties, by the leadership of the Socialist International in August 1914. And I would agree with that. I mean, it's not necessarily the same, but it's of nonetheless, it's of historic significance. And of course, what it leads to is a whole series of disasters as far as the working class movement is concerned. Spain, counter-revolution, France, the failure of the Popular Front government. One can carry on. There are many, many examples of this. But to repeat it, surely, surely not. But yes, I think what we have with the IST tradition is now degeneration to such an extent that they only see the next strike in front of them or the next mass demonstration, that history is now an irrelevance for them. And we saw that, of course, not only in the formation of a popular front, as happened, for example, in many countries in Europe and beyond in the 1930s, but also, surely unprecedented, the formation of a popular front party by the SWP alongside, and you surely can't make this one up, but it's true, isn't it? Alongside the Muslim Brotherhood, the Muslim Association of Britain, led then by Anas Altukhriti, but also with people that self-described themselves as Asian businessmen from the East End of London and Birmingham, that these people were standing on the same platform as part of the same party as the SWP. And it was these people that set the political agenda in respect. So when we put forward a woman's right to choose an abortion, they voted it down and they changed it to a woman's right to wear the veil. When we put forward the abolition of immigration controls, they voted it down. When we put forward republicanism, they voted it down. When we put forward secularism, they voted it down. You couldn't make this stuff up, but they did it. And the SWP rank and file, the SWP cadre, none of them rebelled against this. And so we still have today, there's Richard Boyd Barrett talking about entering into a bourgeois government, and we have not a dicky bird of protest in the pages of Socialist Worker or Party Notes or the International Socialism, the journal, not anything. And indeed, when it comes to Marxism, their annual school, Richard Boyd Barrett is up there on the platform and they cheer him to the rafters. I don't know what's going on with these comrades. Of course, the first famous one, far more significant than Richard Boyd Barrett, of course, was Alexander Mitterrand. Millerand, sorry, Mitterrand, Millerand in France. This was in the tail end of the 19th century when he becomes a minister in the was it Government of Republican Defense, which included in its ranks the butcher of the Paris Commune. Anyway, he not only joined the government, he triggered a series of debates in the international, both in the national sections, but also when it came to the international conferences. So there was a resolution against him in 1900 that famously passed Kolchak's what was dubbed almost instantly as the rubber resolution, because it excused him. That under extreme circumstances, it wasn't illegit. Everyone, bar very few, were against what he'd done. But Kautsky basically wanted to keep the international together and therefore came up with this unprincipled resolution. That was corrected in Germany at their Dresden Conference 1903 when Millerandism was debated and they came out with a much firmer line. They took I think it was August Bebel's line to the Amsterdam conference in 1904. And fortunately, in 1904, that somewhat ambiguous resolution was strengthened and passed. And you would have thought that this was part of our collective heritage on the left. It should have been part of the collective heritage, surely. Of the Communist International in the 1930s, but in the mid 1930s, it broke with that heritage. The SWP clearly broke with that heritage, with its front organizations decisively with respect, to the point where it doesn't know its arse from its principles. Nowadays, does it have any principles nowadays? I really don't think so. Okay, in my last few minutes, don't want to go on over the hour. Just want to deal with Owen Jones. Owen Jones, the Guardian columnist, as you all know, he took the individual decision to announce that he's resigned from the Labour Party. When I heard it initially, I just went, well, so what? It's a gesture, pretty meaningless gesture. He didn't go and say something that got him expelled or suspended or investigated by the Labour Party. In other words, I would presume so far what he's been saying, I mean, when I've read him, he's so damn bland and so, sorry, Owen, so right wing that I would consider you safe in terms of the Starmer regime. Either way, he's chosen to resign. And then I thought to myself, maybe Owen is thinking about a political career of some sort, not as an MP necessarily, but there are all sorts of moves, all sorts of rumours flying around at the moment about the, well, what I'll call, for want of a better word, the post-Corbyn Labour leadership project. So the representatives of Peace and Justice, I'll call it Corbyn's front, along with people from Counterfire, along with people from this, that, and the damned other, have been in negotiations about backing various candidates in the forthcoming general election, standing candidates, for example, against Sir Keir himself in Holborn and St Pancras, but also potentially forming some sort of permanent organisation. Amongst the stories that are going around at the moment is that Paul Mason is going to stand against Jeremy Corbyn. Who cares? Has to be said that while my assessment of Owen Jones doesn't amount to much, he hasn't done a Paul Mason. He's still known as just about a left winger. Worthwhile giving a little bit of background to him. I must admit that I wasn't aware of it. I'm only aware of it because I've been told by others. He was even as a very young person. He was around us, the CPGB, but for more or less seconds. I mean, I must have blinked and he'd come and gone. I more remember Owen Jones when he became a political advisor to John McDonnell, and we were trying to launch, along with other comrades, Hands Off the Peoples of Iran. And Owen was doing his damnedest to stop John McDonnell becoming a sponsor, writing to us saying John McDonnell doesn't want to become a sponsor, John McDonnell telling us he wants to become a sponsor. And of course, Owen's justification for this was Trotsky's line of who is my enemy is my friend, that given the United States is against the Iranian regime, somehow we should be defending the Iranian regime, not demanding that the US doesn't bomb it, the US doesn't sponsor invasions of it. Of course, that's something we would do, but actually defend it in some political way, because we haven't got any arms. And so he was against HOPI, against some sort of campaign that, yeah, said down with imperialism, down with sanctions, but down with the theocracy. Either way, he's still worth reading, that Owen Jones. If you want to read a good little article influenced by Bob Pitt and his journal, What Next? Owen wrote a good little article on the police strike. What was that, 1919, if I'm right? I'm not sure. Or was it before World War I? Someone will correct me. Anyway, he wrote a very good article on that. He wrote an okay-ish article in the launch issue of Tribune, and we're talking about the new Tribune, of where lo and behold, he said, well, actually, clause four ain't really anything to do with socialism. We knew that, but you'd have to tell what used to be called socialist appeal that was the case. Either way, what we saw during Corbyn's leadership was surely unforgivable from Owen Jones. And I just mentioned two things. He basically, how should we put it, treated the witch hunt as genuine, that there were anti-Semites. The left is full of anti-Semitism. And indeed, he was advocating that Jeremy Corbyn himself was replaced, and the candidate that he was pushing was Clive Lewis, God help us. So yeah, in politics, people can forgive each other. I don't know what personal relationship, if any, Owen Jones has with Jeremy Corbyn. It doesn't matter, but I at least get the sniff that Owen is jumping out of the Labour Party because he wants to find himself with a position of influence, and I'll put it no stronger than that, in what comes after. That's what the rumour is now, after the forthcoming general election. Just a quick note on Jeremy Corbyn's chance in Islington North. He has a chance. I'll put it no stronger than that. And at 57, I shall finish.